This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. For listeners of this podcast, Audible is offering a free audiobook to give you a chance to try out their service. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword.
Podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.
Hey everyone, so today's podcast is actually from an earlier recorded Google Hangout session that we did with author Shannon McGuire, also known as Mira Grant, which you will soon learn much more about. So sorry about the audio quality, we pulled it from the YouTube video, so it may not be up to our normal standards. And if you want to see the full video, it will be on the blog and also at my YouTube page at youtube.com/user/earlysound. That's EARLYSOUND. Hope you enjoy it. So we are live right now on Google Plus. Welcome to the Sword and Laser, episode number, 103?
You're asking me?
Tom, you're supposed to be the keeper of the podcast numbers. Yes,
it's episode number 103. So 103.
And so we are doing a live broadcast right now on Google Plus, as I mentioned. And we are joined by Shannon McGuire. Shannon, welcome so much. I hope I'm pronouncing your name properly. It's Shannon, right?
Yes, 10,000 points to you. No one gets it right the first time.
Huzzah! I feel special for doing that. So Shannon, of course, is a very well-renowned writer, and you write, of course, under the pen name of Mira Grant as well, correct?
That is correct, and you got that right, too!
Do people not get that one?
A lot of people call me Myra Grant, which confuses me, because it would be with a Y if it were Myra, but you got both my names right, so we will be sending you a prize.
I feel super special right now, I have to say. I feel like I've gotten all the questions right so far, but I'm not the one asking or receiving the questions tonight. We're going to be interviewing you shortly.
Or are we?
Dun, dun, dun.
So first of all, let's talk a little bit about some of the books you've written in the past. Now, you've primarily done a lot of urban fantasy, and of course, you've done the Newsflesh series. How would you categorize Newsflesh?
It's kind of political science fiction, and it's kind of not. Really, I call them science fiction medical thrillers, and I think that potpourri-like as that sounds, that's about the closest you're going to get, because I really am doing more of the Michael Crichton craziness kind of from a Transmetropolitan meets the West Wing angle. Now, I really sound like alphabet soup, but... I was trying to write a book that would justify talking about zombie biology for 2 years, and I did, and it turned out that that's a medical thriller. So
are zombies something that you've always been fascinated in?
Yes, actually. I started watching Doctor Who when I was 3, and early Doctor Who had a lot of zombies because zombies were cheap, and the BBC was all about how cheaply can we do Doctor Who back then. We actually have pictures of me from a Halloween when I was 6 where I just took some random scarves and tied them around myself and declared that I was a Doctor Who monster. And this is not too far off the actual BBC budget. So that got me fascinated with zombies because they were clearly very versatile or they wouldn't show up on all these different planets. And it all kind of went downhill from there.
So when you sit down to write the Newsflesh series, and you've got this incredibly large backlog of Doctor Who and George Romero and books and movies. How did you decide how you were going to carve out your niche? Did it just hit you immediately, or did you have to navigate those waters?
I spent literally two years before I even started writing, making all of my friends listen to an endless dissertation of how biology would work in a post-zombie America until they finally got really, really sick of me. And one night, Michael actually, in the middle of dinner, just goes, "Shut up and write a book." So I shut up and wrote a book. And that meant that how I was going to handle my niche had already been kind of established, because I had spent 2 years working out zombies that I felt were plausible. At the time, the zombie boom was just kind of getting started. We were just at the very beginning of people really picking up the zombies and playing with them again. And I was very frustrated by the number of folks that thought, well, the dead are walking, that's enough. That there didn't have to be any explanation, there didn't have to be any motivation, and there also didn't have to be any acknowledgement that there was no explanation. Like, if the dead broke in right now to our three respective rooms while we were doing this podcast, we wouldn't know where they came from, and we would not care. It would not be a thing with which we concerned ourselves. Running and screaming is what we would concern ourselves with. But frankly, the Centers for Disease Control are going to be kind of concerned. Pretty much instantly, there will be people thinking about it and working on it. And I just really hated that we kept ignoring those folks.
So as someone who's written extensively about zombies, what is your, if people out there haven't read Newsflesh, what is your zombie mythos here? How did the whole thing get started?
I'm doing a purely virological zombie. It's the result of two genetically engineered viruses, kind of, you know, it's the classic story. Boy meets girl, they flirt a little, they share genetic material, they interlock their protein hooks, they bring about a worldwide Armageddon. Everyone's infected. It doesn't matter if you're bitten or not. When you die, you will rise. If you're bitten, you'll just rise a heck of a lot faster. But I think that the really big change was that we won. Because my zombies are virological, and because I do believe in public health and in the ability of the CDCs and USAID and all of these other organizations to respond, humanity won. We just have to deal with the fact that there are still zombies and grandma wants to eat you.
I think that's one of the most fascinating parts of the series is the fact that, and I've only I haven't really seen this done much, if at all, that the zombies and us are having some kind of coexistence. How does that work?
Don't mess with a zombie, pretty much. How do we coexist with rabies? I mean, really stop and think for a second about rabies. It is nastier than anything anyone is going to come up with. Honestly, given a choice between being locked in a house with someone with rabies and locked in a house with someone with Ebola, I'll take the Ebola. It's harder to catch, and it does not turn you into a homicidal maniac who is still fully capable of getting up, walking around, and operating doors. Airborne rabies is the worst case scenario. And it just sort of kicks around. We've got it. It's out there. Maybe that raccoon in your yard has it. Maybe those bats in your yard have it. Maybe your dog that you forgot to vaccinate last year because it's expensive and rabies doesn't really happen has it. You know, we've only had two people ever that contracted rabies that recovered. One of them, we don't know why she recovered. The other one, he got better. And that's kind of the angle I took. We can learn to coexist with anything. Humanity is really good at coexisting with shit that wants us dead.
So if you had to choose between rabies and zombie virus, which one would you take?
Do I get my zombie virus, or am I looking at, like, the T-virus?
Let's do your zombie virus.
I would take my zombie virus in a heartbeat. Side effects include no colds, no flus, no cancer. Like, best zombie virus ever.
So we have a few questions from our audience, and this one comes from Tamahome.
I've got one more question before we get to Tamahome.
Oh, okay, sorry.
You posit that one of the reasons we survived the zombie apocalypse is because horror movies helped train us. We have the benefit of having thought about it. Does the Newsflesh series contribute to our actual survival prospects?
It does not now. I have unfortunately created an alternate timeline. So probably when Kellis Amberley is created here, it'll melt us or something. I really apologize for condemning you.
Oh, well. It was worth a shot.
I think that's very realistic, though, because I feel as though if we had a zombie apocalypse right now, I think that I've got a plan in place. And this is because there's been so much zombie, you know, fiction going around in the past 10 years or 25 years, actually. Do you feel like if the zombie apocalypse happened that you'd have a plan, that you'd be ready?
I have a plan, but it depends on where I am. I do a lot of conventions, and I still have a day job. And my day job is in an indefensible building full of people who don't have plans. So my plan, if the zombies come while I'm at the day job, is kind of run and get eaten somewhere interesting. But if I'm at home and have access to my weapons and my go bag, I have a plan. I know where I'm going. I know how I'm getting there. I know not to tell anyone where I'm going or how I'm getting there. Because unfortunately, I'm not better prepared than everyone else on the planet. And yet a lot of people go, oh, it's Mira Grant, follow her. I'm like, no, don't follow me. Really, don't.
You're like, no, I'm Shannon. I'm not.
Shannon has no good plan. Don't follow her. Because, dude, there's like 80 of you, and I don't know how many are infected. Leave.
We've done the zombie survival class at Dragon Con for a couple of years. What's that group called, Tom? Do you remember?
I think it's Zombie Preparedness Network, but I wouldn't bet my life on it.
And what I like about them is that they not only teach zombie survival, but they also teach, you know, actual regular survival in case, you know, shit hits the fan. So I think that's great. I also have a plan in place that I will not say out loud because good. I live in a heavily populated area, and I don't want too many people to get that same idea because it's pretty good. Maybe I'll tell Tom. Maybe.
I think that is kind of the greatest strength of the current wave of zombie apocalypse planning. I live in an area where the earth could split open and swallow me at any moment. So we all have go bags. We've all had go bags for my entire life, and they look a lot like most people's zombie preparedness bags. So saying, hey, what would you do if the zombies came, gives you the opportunity to make plans for an apocalyptic scenario, for something that is really bad and really destructive to your way of life, without actually needing to think, my way of life is going to end tomorrow. You can go, oh, ha, ha, yeah, I'm planning for the zombies, just going to put this crate of water in this closet, ha, ha, see my clever plan. Well, congratulations, you've just cleverly actually planned for something happening if something does.
Yeah, so for the most part.
You know.
And if that makes it easier to plan for that kind of stuff, then
I don't need a crossbow for my earthquake preparedness.
Oh, no?
Well, maybe I do.
Yeah, you might. There could be looting, depending on how long the power's out.
All right, fair point.
You're that the only house with a generator. Yeah, the house the earthquake comes in the middle of summer and knocks out all the power, and you're the only house with a generator, and thus the only house with AC. When it's 112 outside, you are gonna want melee weapons.
Do you think people would kill over AC? I never really thought about that. I would think they would kill over, you know, food or water or other things that are, you know, intrinsic to our survival. But I guess if it's that hot, people want to be comfortable too.
Yeah.
I think we have unfortunately seen that once panic really kicks in, people will kill over anything. You know, you will get, if things ever were to get bad enough from a social standpoint, you will get people killing for your AC. You'll get people killing because you have the last unexpired can of Diet Coke.
That's a good point. Well, moving on from our go bags, let's take Tamahome's question. They want to know, as one of the hosts of SF Squeecast, what are you squeeing over lately, and can I have a cookie?
Well, no, because it's my cookie. I don't have any extra cookies right now. I'm sorry. We are at the end of cookie season. What I'm squeeing over recently, let's see. I am absolutely in love with the new season of Phineas and Ferb.
Nice.
Go team Phineas and Ferb. I know, but it's the best thing. Oh, and the people who created Phineas and Ferb, this I'm really squeeing about. My cat, Thomas, has a plush Perry the Platypus that I got for him at Disneyland. And he loves his Perry the Platypus, and he hugs it, and he cuddles it. He doesn't bite it at all. He just wants to love Perry. And I took some pictures and put them on Twitter, and the creators of Phineas and Ferb saw them and were like, your cat has great taste. I'm like, yes, he does. I'm loving Avengers vs. X-Men. It's one of the better comic crossovers Marvel's done in a while. Even if I am terrified with every progressive issue that Jean Grey is going to come back from the dead, please don't bring Jean Grey back from the dead. And Rock of Ages, which just came out, it's a jukebox musical. It's fantastic. I saw it twice on Saturday. The second time was because the theater had air conditioning, but I wouldn't have gone again if it wasn't a great movie. It's really awesome. And Tom Cruise can actually sing.
Yes. This is true. Wow. Like, so I'm getting a sense that air conditioning is a central theme in both your writing and life.
Record setting.
It must be hot where you are. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Right now, air conditioning is like a constant running. Is the AC on? Maybe we should turn the AC off. Is the AC on? Also, I have long-haired cats, and when the AC goes off, they tell me.
Oh, yeah. Cats don't like that.
Yeah, too much. In the morning, they tell me.
So tell us a little bit more about SF Squeakcast. So it's another podcast, audio podcast, right? And you guys talk about stuff that you're really excited about?
It is an ongoing SF roundtable of vague positivity, which means that you are expected to bring things that you're happy about, that you're excited about. You don't have to be over the moon, although I try to bring things I'm over the moon about because I get really cynical really fast if I'm not completely in love with a thing. And then we all just sort of talk about them. And if somebody else brings something that you don't like, you can say, hey, not my cup of tea, glad you like it, rather than starting to get into this big debate about whether Phineas and Ferb is appropriate children's entertainment due to a lack of strong feminine role models, or whether we should really be making jukebox musicals when we still don't have a good film version of Wicked. So it's nice to just have that, in a world where everything is negative, moment of positivity. It doesn't mean we don't understand that the things we love have flaws. You know, we know that they're there, and we'll discuss those endlessly, too. But for an hour or so, once a month, we get to just talk about what makes us happy and, you know, remind people that that's okay.
And you've got a pretty great list of other authors that are on the show. Can you tell us who they are?
Well, it's me, obviously. Elizabeth Bear, who has the best dog. Catherine Valenti, who has the best island. I love She lives on an island in Maine, and I went to stay with her this last summer. Well, this summer. I keep thinking of it as a million years ago. And it's like walking into a Stephen King novel. You're just like, oh, here I am. At any moment, a killer clown is going to pop out from behind something, and that's okay.
Low men in yellow coats around
the
corner.
Don't even start, Tom, talking about Stephen King, because
Tom,
he has been... Oh, gosh, here we go.
No, I'll come back. But Tom, the day that we went, or rather not the day, but I went for the week that corresponded with the explosion at the Kitchener Ironworks, which is the earliest recorded start point for the 27-year cycle. And then we went out to Bangor, which is, of course, the model for Derry, Maine, and did the all-day IT tour. We went to the Kissing Bridge.
Oh,
we went to the Standpipe, which is so much rounder than you think it is. Oh, my God. And we went out in the Barrens, and we found the house on Niebolt Street. It's actually there. It's so creepy. No kidding. And then we had dinner at Jade of the Orient. We actually ate at the Chinese restaurant, and they had little jade turtles in the gift shop, so Kat and I each got a turtle.
Oh, that's awesome. The turtle.
The turtle cannot help you.
You're turning into Squeakcast right now, or at least Tom has.
That's good.
It was the best day. Paul Cornell is also on the podcast. Paul and I did sort of the proto-Squeakcast at Worldcon in Australia. They gave us an hour-long panel just to talk about why we love Fringe.
Oh, nice.
So we did that, and then we were all, that was so much fun. We wish we could do that every day. And Lynn Thomas heard us say it. And Lynn is one of those people that you say things in front of her, and you turn around, and suddenly there's an entire, like, bake sale going on around you to support the cause you mentioned in passing. So we said where Lynn could hear us, we wish we could do that every day. And we blinked, and we had a podcast.
That's awesome.
That's fantastic. Tangled wants to know how you got involved with Filk music and how it influences your writing.
I still go, although not as many, thankfully, to a lot of science fiction conventions. And when I was 14, I didn't think that you should ever have to sleep at a science fiction convention because you had paid to be at the con and sleep was wasted time. Plus, I couldn't afford a hotel room. So I would wander around in the halls a lot at 10 and 11 at night looking for things to do. And I found rooms with people with guitars singing songs. And some of them could sing very, very well, and some of them couldn't so much. But everybody was happy to hear from everyone else, and everyone applauded. And when you're 14 and looking for unrelenting acceptance, it was like heroin for my tiny, lonely 14-year-old brain. I could go sit in this room and sing show tunes, and everyone would clap and be happy to see me. So that's how I found Filk, and what I discovered was it really is that accepting. You could show up tomorrow and be like, hey, it's my first Filk Con, and you would find 30 people going, welcome, we're so glad you're here. If there's anything we can do, would you like, these are the best CDs, these are the best songs, here's the beginner's circle, here are some lyric sheets, let's have fun. So it is still the most accepting corner of fandom I've ever found.
So I don't know too much about Filk. Can you give me a little more background on it?
Well, Filk is the folk music of science fiction and fantasy, essentially.
I've seen panels about it at different cons that I've been to, but I've never sat in on one.
Well, it's been around basically as long as fandom has been. If you read some of the classics of our genre, I think the best example is probably Dream Park by Niven and Pornell. You'll find that they've put in Filk lyrics. They've put in rewritten lyrics to classic folk songs, to songs everyone knows. And that's how Filk really started, was people having folk song sing-alongs in their hotel rooms at conventions. You know, they'd sing about Star Trek, and they'd sing about how fun it would be to go sailing among the stars, and wouldn't it be nice to have a unicorn. And as this went on, people started writing their own songs. They started writing their own melodies to go with these lyrics. And gradually, you know, oh, well, now we need a room to do the filking in because we no longer all fit in this one hotel room. Well, now would be really nice if we could have some panel space. You know what? There's too many of us here. Let's just have a convention. There are parodies. There's original music. There's a cat in my lap, which I know you can see if you're watching the video feed. You know, there are entire conventions. There are hundreds of Filkers worldwide. And it's just a big, thriving, accepting community. My most recent Filk CD, Wicked Girls, is actually the first Filk CD to be nominated for a Hugo. It's on this year's ballot. And that's a testament, in part, to just how many Filkers there are out there. I know a lot of non-Filkers that have listened to and loved the album, for which I'm very, very grateful, but it would never have gotten that kind of exposure if the Filk community weren't so big and so supportive. As for how Filk informs my writing, it doesn't so much. I actually try not to be terribly lyrical when I'm writing because, well, you shouldn't be overly lyrical when you're writing about zombies chewing someone's face off. I think that that crosses a line into Ed Wood territory very quickly.
Could, yeah.
You know?
I don't know. I think it would be kind of awesome, actually.
It would be entertaining.
I could get behind that.
Depends on what you're going for.
Entertaining is a parody, yeah. But Filk was the first place where I could present my writing and not have to do that classic, oh, a friend of mine wrote this, that I think we all kind of encountered as teenagers. My friend had this idea for a story. My friend was in this gaming campaign. No, you could walk in. I'd walk into a Filk room at 15 and say, I wrote this song. And people would listen, and they would be happy to hear something that came from me. So I got a lot of confidence as a writer, you know, from Filk and from being able to present my work as my work.
That's great. And so where are you performing next? Do you have any upcoming cons?
I'm actually going to be guest of honor at Confluence, which is out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and that's next month, and I will be doing a concert there, and that should be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to it. I actually have finished most of my Filk commitments for this year. I am doing a concert at Worldcon, which is going to be exciting. So that'll be great. My entire normal rotating band is there.
Wow.
I have a group of people that I perform with most regularly. Yeah, so I'm going to have S.J. Tucker. I'm going to have Betsy Tinney. I'm going to have Michelle Dockery and Tony Fabri. And I'm just really, really thrilled because it's the people I love performing with, the very best. And Amy McNally, my fiddler, who we're all fairly sure I sold my soul at the crossroads and just forgot about it. So she's been practicing steadily for the last couple years. And it's always good to have an opportunity to play with her, since one day she'll have to fiddle the devil for my soul.
We got to get to Worldcon one of these days. So let's take a brief moment to thank our sponsor. This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 100,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many of the New York Times bestsellers. And of course, if you want to try out Audible.com, we recommend you check out the Newsflesh trilogy by Samira Grant, Seanan McGuire.
Narrated by Paula Christensen and Jesse Bernstein.
Who are awesome.
If you're like, wait a minute, good. Feed is in there, but so is Deadline and Blackout. So if you haven't started, you could start with Feed, or you could pick up Deadline or Blackout wherever you are in the series. And listeners of our audio podcast can try it for free. If you're not already a member of Audible, go to audiblepodcast.com/sword, and you can download one free audiobook of your choice, no obligation. That's audiblepodcast.com/sword, and we thank them for their support.
Mm-hmm. And one is almost never enough, trust me. But let's get back to some zombies here. We have a question from P. Aaron, who writes, so, Night of the Living Dead, original or remake, and why?
Night of the Living Dead, definitely original. The remake, lost a lot of the integrity, I thought, of the first one. I'm a big believer in whatever you're going to do, you have to do it with total commitment. Ironically, this is a discussion I was just having earlier today about Piranaconda on the Sci-Fi Channel this past weekend. It fell down. It feels like the Sci-Fi Channel Saturday Night Movies have lost their integrity. They're no longer willing to just commit.
There was a certain sort of ignorant awesome to the Sci-Fi Saturday Movies before they realized it was kitschy, I feel like. And now it's like they're pandering.
They are, and they're not at all thinking through, would this be scary? Would this be effective? Would this even work? You can't have two 100-foot-long alpha apex predators in Hawaii. There's nothing for them to eat. They've run out of people long before they get to breeding stage. Whereas if they had done what I was originally assuming they would and had like a swarm of 20-foot-long piranaconda that just chase you down and bite the crap out of you, that would have been terrifying. I wouldn't be sleeping. The original Night of the Living Dead was very cheap. It was very shoestring, but it was very sincere. They had something to say. They were going to say it. It was said. The remake, it felt largely like what they were saying was, we have a bigger effects budget.
Mm-hmm.
And they kind of lost the immediacy and the sincerity of the original without having something new to say. Dawn of the Dead, you have the original and you have the remake, and they are making very different points about consumerism and capitalism in two very different times. So having both of them, they're both able to be sincere, they're both able to be very committed to their message without recreating each other shot for shot. Whereas the second Night of the Living Dead, it felt less like this movie has integrity and more like we are pandering to people who would really like to see the zombies being a bit gorier and a bit more self-aware. That's the other thing. The first Night of the Living Dead was not self-aware. It was a thing. It was a new thing. And you can't do that twice.
So you're okay with the Dawn of the Dead remake then?
James Gunn needs to call me. I actually really love the Dawn of the Dead remake.
Yeah.
Running zombies are a new thing, and I know there are some zombie purists that have problems with them, but these are people being purists over a genre of movie that didn't exist until about 30 years ago. You can't be too much of a purist. Honestly, the original zombies, George Romero's zombies, didn't run largely because he couldn't afford that good of camera work. You know, it was not some great statement of implacability. It wasn't the reason that Jason Voorhees never runs, which Jason Voorhees never runs because Jason Voorhees doesn't have to run. Zombies didn't run because Romero couldn't afford to. Now they can.
It's funny how that kind of stuff becomes canon. And then even when it didn't have, like you said, any kind of intention behind it other than just sheer necessity, it becomes a thing that is, you know, de facto. It's very interesting.
Yeah, or like the brains thing. Brains is not from a Romero movie at all. It's from Return of the Living Dead, which was made by his partner, which is much more of a horror comedy. And he had a whole explanation for why zombies need to eat brains. He made it make sense in that context. And yet now everyone, you say zombie and they say brains. I don't see why a zombie would want to eat your brains. They're hard to get to. It's not like getting to the chewy chocolate center of a Tootsie Roll Pop. You know, there's a lot to work through. You're going to break some teeth on that thing. My zombies are like, buttocks.
Like, you know? Guts.
Yeah, easy to get to.
Bicep. Anything they can just bite off.
But buttocks doesn't have quite the same, you know, sound to it that brains does.
Breasts.
Boobies.
Yeah, see, and those are like pure fat. That's, to a zombie, that's a Zagnut bar.
So who do you think right now is doing it right in zombie world?
Jonathan Mabry is definitely doing it right when he does it. He's got his Rotten Ruin YA series, and they are just fantastic. He is having so much fun, and he's got such a good grasp on his universe. Daryl Gregory, who is not really known as a zombie author. He's more of a transhumanist, interesting concepts, you don't know what I'm going to do, but it will be interesting author. And his book last year, The Raising of Stony Mayhall, was one of the best zombie novels I've read in forever. And he actually really went into not only why would zombies be kind of shambly and, you know, unintelligent at the start and then get smarter, which is a trend that we've seen with our movie zombies, but he went into why would a zombie be able to move a dead body around at all? You know, why could a dead body get up and go? I have loved every zombie of James Gunn's that I've ever encountered. From Slither, where they were alien parasites. I think I was the Northern California box office take for Slither. I saw that movie in the double digits in theaters. I wrote a song about it. I love, that's actually why Mira Grant is Mira Grant, because Grant and Star, you know, Grant and Starla Grant were the two.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
I named my pseudonym after Starla Grant.
That's
in
awesome.
Slither.
You know, we have some questions about your pseudonym, if we can get to them. Fall wanted to know, when setting up a pen name, what does one hope to accomplish? Is it a way to channel another part of your own character, or is it a separate genre? And James S.A. Corey, we talked to Daniel Abraham and Ty Frank the other day, and they said that it was sort of a branding, so you knew what kind of story you were going to get. What made you choose Mira Grant?
The latter, honestly. As Shannon, I write urban fantasy. I actually write more pure horror as Shannon than I do as Mira. Mira is much more science fiction, much more cerebral, whereas when I'm really, like, going, I can be incredibly creepy at a length of 20 pages or under, and all of that has been published as Shannon. But really, I explain it to people usually with the Disney Touchstone thing. In the early 90s, Disney wanted to start releasing R-rated movies, but they didn't want parents taking their kids to see Walt Disney's Reservoir Dogs. They were really afraid of people going, oh, it's the Disney brand, it's totes safe to take my 7-year-old. Let's rock it! Oh my God, Mommy! So they created
Touchstone. I don't like Mr. Pink.
Yeah, exactly. Wholly owned subsidiary, completely public. There was never an inch of transparency between them. But just putting Touchstone on the poster rather than Disney changed the way people looked at the poster. It changed the immediate perception of the movie. With Mira Grant and Shannon McGuire, I've never pretended I'm not Mira. There was never a quarter inch of illusion there. I actually wrote Feed myself as Shannon McGuire. We knew I might be asked to have a pseudonym. I actually hoped I'd be allowed to have a pseudonym. But we shopped it with that transparency and saying, I've been talking about this book on the internet for 2 years.
That's funny because we got nervous because when we first started talking with you on email, like, we obviously knew you were Mira Grant and also Shannon, but we had this, like, brief second of, like, oh, crap, does everyone else know that they're not the same person? And we got scared that we were, like, giving you away.
That they are.
It's so silly because you are so transparent about it, but there was that, like, brief second of oh, crap.
Oh, some people still get fooled. I periodically get email, and this email is what really reinforces my thought that I made the right decision. Mira Grant fans that find out I'm Shannon will buy Shannon's books, and then they will write me going, oh my God, did you know that your publisher put icky girly fairies in this book? And I'm like, they're not very girly, actually, and I put them there. I majored in folklore at UC Berkeley. Did you? Okay. And vice versa. Shannon fans will suddenly find out that I'm Mira, and, oh my gosh, I've missed 3 books. Yay! Which is exactly the response I want from people right up until I get the letter saying, this book contained violence and gore, and you said fuck so many times. I'm like, I say fuck a lot, guys. Like, really. But there is that, like, 2%, the outliers, that are really traumatized by the work I publish under the other name. And that reinforces that I needed that brand at the top of it. Even if you know both books are me, you're going to go into a Mira Grant book expecting science and blood, and you're going to go into a Shannon McGuire book expecting something not lighter, but cleaner.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm glad we didn't blow your cover. That's all I'm saying. Your fake cover that didn't exist. Jenny wants to know, do you put yourself in different mindsets when you're writing under different names?
No. Sometimes I don't even know who is writing what until it's done. And I go, okay, who wants to buy this? Oh, you want a Mira Grant story. Okay, this could be a Mira Grant story. There are things that are definitely Shannon stories or definitely Mira stories. I got asked to be in an anthology, which I will not name. They actually did not wind up moving forward. They couldn't find a publisher, but they asked Shannon for a story. So I gave them a story pitch, came up with something, said, this is what I will write. Here we go. And they came back to us a couple months later and said, we really want a Mira Grant story. But the story that I had said I would write for them was not a Mira Grant story. It was a Shannon story. It had all of the Shannon hallmarks and really would not work as a Mira Grant piece. I write less short fiction as Mira, so I do fewer anthologies as Mira, and I was not willing to accept a place in that anthology as Mira. She's harder to do in short form than Shannon is, because when I'm being me, I don't have to do that much science, and when I'm being Mira, I have to show my math. And if you've only got 6,000 words, your math is really taking away from your word count.
I have to say I'm a tiny bit disappointed that you don't, like, put on a black wig and a big shroud and
oh, I have a wig.
Refuse to be called anything but Mira when you're writing the, you're talking to Mira now.
Why does she have to talk like that?
I don't know.
No, when I'm being creepy, I'll sneak up on my little sister when she's, like, brushing her teeth and has woken me up because she goes to bed later than I do, and I'll just come up behind her and go, hello, Mira. And then she'll scream and, like, flail at me with her toothbrush. So
awesome.
I think Mira is much, much creepier if she sounds like the bride of Chucky.
That's a good point. Your facts, your FAQs on your websites are some of the best I've ever read. How did you get so good at writing those?
Boredom and years of internet quizzes. When I was a girl, you know, 20 million years ago in internet time, we didn't have Tumblr and we didn't have Twitter and all of these other ways to amuse ourselves when we were supposed to be working. So instead we would pass around endless personality quizzes. You know, what's your name, what's your sign, what's your sex, blah, blah, blah. And I filled those out for me. I filled them out for every character in every story I was writing. I filled them out for characters in role-playing games. And it turns out that eventually this leads to refining a very strange and specific style of writing, which is the surrealistic, pithy answer to a stupid question.
Gosh, role-playing games. You are probably now the seventh or eighth writer that we've talked to in the past 2 months that has credited role-playing games with part of their either success or their world-building. So that's interesting. So what role-playing games were you into?
I played a lot of World of Darkness, so very much World of Darkness. I actually mushed for a long time. Jim Butcher and I were on some of the same mushes.
Oh, cool.
Many years ago.
We love Jim Butcher.
Yes, he eventually quit so he could go off and have a real writing career. And I said, I don't have to quit to have a writing career. I can do both. And mysteriously, I didn't. And then I quit. And 6 months later, I had a real writing career. So it's clear that time sinks are bad, kids. D&D, I played a lot of Marvel superheroes. I was in a wild cards game that lasted for 6 years. And I played so much Champions, all the Champions. Although mostly what I enjoyed about Champions was character generation, so I kept trying to kill everyone else so that we would have to make new characters because I loved the math. Yay, Wild Cards!
We're interviewing George R. R. Martin, too, tomorrow, so I'm brushing up on my Wild Cards. That's great. Yeah. So, okay, I think that's all the questions we've got. Thank you so much, Shannon, for taking the time to chat with us and answer our listener questions. So where can people follow your work online?
You can follow me at www.shannonmcguire.com. If that is difficult to spell, which it is, you can probably find me just by going on Google and looking up Rosemary and Rue or Discount Armageddon or Cheese and Cake. Any of these will find you the spelling of my name. I'm not kidding. If you look up cheese and cake as a phrase in quotes, you come to Shannon fairly quickly. You can also follow me at www.miragrant.com. That's Mira with an I. That site is updated a lot more rarely because, well, I'm trying to maintain two sites and it kind of is juggly. I'm on Twitter pretty much constantly because it is short and simple and does not distract from word count that much.
Absolutely. And now you're also on Google Plus because we forced you to sign up for it today, so you could be on this hangout.
I am deleting this profile the second we're done.
Oh. Well, again.
The one problem I found with the social medias is that anytime I'm on them, people use them to message me. And then they get mad when I don't respond to their messages that are stored within a social media platform that I check once every 6 months. So if you go to my Facebook, the wall consists of links someone has put there. Link, 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 link. Me going, please don't use Facebook Messenger. I never check it ever. Link someone has put there. Link, 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 link scrolls off my message. No, seriously, guys, please don't use Facebook Messenger. I never check it ever. I've lost so much time-sensitive stuff because people sent it to my Facebook Messenger.
Yeah.
So I live in terror of new social media platforms now.
I can relate to that. But again, thank you so much for joining us.
No problem.
Maybe we'll see you at a con sometime.
Most excellent. Thanks for having me, y'all.
Thanks, Shannon.
And if you want to get in touch with us, the email address is feedback@SwordandLaser. Our website is swordandlaser.com. And all of our discussions happen over on Goodreads. And we will see you guys next time.